Take your Bibles back out, and let's get over to Numbers chapter 22. Part of why the timeline is so helpful here is in Numbers 22, I'm going to point to this screen, we are like right here at the end of the wilderness wanderings, just about at the end of the older disbelieving generation. Thank you, Larry. I had some things down, but not everything. That should be better. We'll try that out. We are right in Numbers 22 at the end of the disbelieving generation. The younger generation is about to rise up and take over, and they will then, again, transition to Joshua's leadership and go into the land. That makes this an exciting point in Israel's history. It makes it a pivotal point in their history, and that adds some neat context to this story. Now, what do we know Balaam's story for best? What do we associate him with? This is a real question. Talking donkey. Now, I have a tortoise and a cat at home, and neither one of them have ever spoken to me. I don't have a donkey yet, maybe someday. But that makes this story a lot of fun, right? But there's also some really significant spiritual, some maybe difficult passages in here. But it makes it a really exciting thing for us to look at. So I've been looking forward to this study. I do need to maybe note that because we are looking at four chapters of text, we're going to move fast. Not crazy fast, but relatively quickly, and we're going to note some of the high points in the text. So that may be a little bit different than the approach we normally would adopt, but bear with me. We're going to get the main points summarized and do this at a relatively high level, and that will help us to see the key and main ideas from this text. So I want to begin Balaam's story by introducing us to this. Balak, this guy over here on the left, or my left, your right, is the king of Moab. This is just a representation, of course. I'm going to call him bad guy number one. He starts the problems, and he's pretty much there until the problems all get resolved in a very violent way at the end of this story. He is the instigator, bad guy number one. That takes us then to Balaam, who I'm going to call bad guy number two. He's riding his donkey, so we know who it is. He is a sorcerer, which just means he's into magical, mystical, witchcrafty sorts of things. He is very much a troublemaker in this story, like Balak, and they work closely together. There's a couple other things I think we need to know about Balaam. He is famous. I never knew that about Balaam until preparing for this. That was good for me. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. He's also somewhat wealthy. He has a couple of servants who travel with him. So imagine rich and famous Balaam, but often people who are rich and famous want to get richer and famouser. Not quite a word, but close enough. And that's kind of how Balaam is. I would say that is probably his chief motivation. So at times, God will work with Balaam. He will talk to Balaam. God will talk through Balaam. But we shouldn't take Balaam as a good, godly, righteous prophet. He's a guy who's after riches and fame and more and more and more, who God happens to use for his purposes. So when we see Balaam do and say things that look nice and shiny, just know there's more to the story. Okay? Our third character, who very rarely, I think, gets associated with this, is a man by the name of Phinehas. If you've never heard of Phinehas before, this is not the son of Samuel who dies in 1 Samuel. This is a different Phinehas. Okay? He is one of the grandsons of Aaron, the very first high priest. And at this point in Numbers, he is just a priest. He's not high priest. But he's our good guy. We've had two bad guys. We need a good guy, and Phinehas is that good guy. He does some bold, decisive, courageous things. Larry is walking to me, so I'm going to try and not mess with it too much. Yeah, Larry says it's my transmitter. That may be so. I'm going to try and work with it, and I trust if there's a better solution, I will be advised of it. So, guys, thank you for hanging with me. Phinehas, again, is a priest. He does some big, important things for God's glory, but also for the good of God's people. And in many ways, Phinehas is super closely linked with Balaam and his story. And that's important for our purposes tonight. Otherwise, everything ends in disaster. So those are our major characters. Excuse me. We are going to take just a note here of the setting. I'm going to try and move this down just a little further. We are mostly going to be down here in Moab, this lower kind of yellow star. That's where most everything takes place here. But Balaam is from up here-ish. We don't know exactly where Pethor, his hometown, is, but somewhere up there. That's somewhere between 400 and 500 miles between those two stars. So imagine we don't have cars and airplanes, and I send for somebody 500 miles away. I would only do that if they're famous enough I've heard of them, which is a big deal from 400 or 500 miles away, and if I'm really, really sure they can help me, right? And that tells us some really significant things about Balaam, because the text is going to paint a completely different picture of who Balaam is and the power and influence that he has. Let me switch mics, I think. Correct, Larry? Okay, bear with me just a Okay, we're going to give that a try. So far, so good. That's right. They offered me the what I call the Garth Brooks mic, and that just I struggle with those. So we're going to try this one out. Okay, that takes us into the text. We've gone through a little bit of the background. Thank you for bearing with me there. I'm going to suggest we break the text down in this way in terms of an outline, and we're going to work through these sections and then a note on chapter 25. So we'll get to that in just a moment. We're going to mostly skip over 23 and 24, not because they're unimportant, but because there's lots in there that we just don't have time to look at. So if you enjoy our study and go, wow, that is a cool story, go back and read it. It won't take very long, and it's a lot of fun. So Numbers chapter 22, we need to get introduced to what's going on. Let's do that by reading verses 2 through 6. Israel is in the plains of Moab, and the text says here, Numbers 22, verse 2, and Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was in great dread of the people, because they were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, this horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the people of Ammah, to call him, saying, behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So that's why I'm calling this first section called to curse. A couple of really big, important ideas. How does Balak feel about Israel? He doesn't like them very much. We don't talk about oxen licking up grass very often, but he goes, they're going to ruin me, my people, and my land, and there's lots of them, and they're mighty. We should not underestimate the significance of Israel coming out of Egypt, because that would have been almost completely unthinkable with how mighty Egypt was at the time. So Balak doesn't like them. He's also terrified, right? And he goes, I got to do something about this. And that's why, of course, he summons Balaam to come and help him. But there's another really significant note text we're told about Israel, that there's many people, many people. They're mighty. They came out of Egypt. They've conquered the Amorites. So how did they get that way? Who did that for them? Not, well, say it again, Jenny. Right, God did. And I just want to make sure that we catch that right up front. The text is saying, look, God kept his promises. He said he would make a mighty nation with lots of people, and guess what? Mighty nation with lots of people. God did exactly what he said he would do. And God said he would bless these people. So if Balaam comes and tries to curse them, is that going to work out? No way, no how. Now, if you've ever been to an action movie, you know how action movies end. Eventually, the good guy wins. It may take three movies, but eventually the good guy wins. So we know how this story ends. But if we're reading it for the very first time, or if we're an Israelite experiencing it and we go, oh man, he sent for Balaam, that famous sorcerer, we're kind of worried. There's some tension here. And so the rest of the story says, okay, we need to see what's really going on. That does take us to our next section, which I'm calling Refusal Reversed. Let's go a little bit down in the text to verse 12, still in Numbers 22 and verse 12. Balak sends messengers. They come and talk with Balaam. He says, okay, let me go find out what God says. And here's the encounter. God said to Balaam, this is Numbers 22 and verse 12, God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go to your own land, for the Lord has refused, to let me go with you. Did Balaam say something true? That's where we nod our heads. Yes, he absolutely did. But do you hear kind of a blame game in how he says that? It's not, don't go curse Israel, it won't work out. It's, God won't let me go with you. Now, I'm putting my spin on that a little, but I think there's a hint of that in the text. Balaam says, it's God's fault, I cannot go. The messengers go back, and they come and tell Balak, a king, yeah, that guy you sent us to go get, he said no. And kings don't like hearing no. So guess what Balak does? He sends back more guys who are more important, and with not just the fee for divination, with a greater promise of reward. There's that riches and fame that Balaam is after. And we need to again see what happens. Let's look at verse 18 now in the text. Numbers 22, 18. The messengers have come. They've told Balaam what they're after. And Balaam answered them and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, hint, hint, that's what Balaam's after, if he were to do that, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord my God to do less or more. And it should end there, right? God said, don't go. But Balaam goes on. I must obey the command of my Lord. Now, verse 19. So, you too, please stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. We learn a lot about Balaam in that statement. He wants riches and fame. And if he has to go back and try and fake like God is giving him permission, he's willing to do that if it helps him get to his goal. And so we are somewhat surprised when God says, okay, you may go, here in verse 20, but only do what I tell you. That seems a little bit strange, but we know that God knows what he's doing. So the next morning, Balaam gets up and saddles his donkey and heads down to Moab. And we get to verse 22, and we read, but God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his adversary. That's kind of a head-scratcher verse for us. God said, yes, you may go, but obey, and Balaam goes, and now God's angry. What's going on there? Well, for that, we've got to put some pieces together, right? We know some things about Balaam. He's not after God's purposes as much as he is after his own. And in fact, a little bit later in the text, the angel who is standing in his way as an adversary will say, your paths, your ways are perverse, crooked, evil. It's not that Balaam is going to Moab, it's what Balaam is planning and plotting to do. So we just need to be mindful of that. God's not flip-flopping here. It's a Balaam problem, not a God problem. And that, of course, leads to our famous encounter that we know well, the talking donkey and everything associated with that, which is a cool, cool story. Weird, but cool. But there's one other thing that we need to make sure we know and be aware of in the text. Of everybody who's on this trip, who is the one person who should be able to see and influence the angel? Who's the one person? That's kind of a weird question, isn't it? Who's the magical, mystical guy who's supposed to be able to bless and curse? Balaam is. So as we're going down the way and we see an angel come and stand in the way as an adversary, Balaam, if he has the power he claims to, should be able to go, oh, hey, look, there's an angel. I'll go have a chat with him and tell him that it's okay. God said this was fine. And then he'll go on his way and we'll go down to Moab. But that's not how it plays out, right? The person or individual, maybe we should say, who can see the angel is not magical, mystical Balaam. It's his dumb donkey, which is just ridiculously humorous. Balaam doesn't have power to bless and curse. God does. God is in control and God is sovereign. We're again being taught some really significant things. And then the story unfolds as we're familiar with. Balaam keeps on going to Moab and the donkey keeps turning aside until finally, after the third time, turns into the field, into the wall, and then just lays flat down. Finally, God opens two things. He opens the mouth of the donkey. That's the part we know really, really well. And the donkey actually asks Balaam three very logical questions, which essentially amount to, this isn't normal, right, Balaam? And then God opens Balaam's eyes, and he sees the angel, and he humbles himself. That's the right natural response. And the angel warns him and says exactly what we would expect. You may go, but obey. You've been warned by God. You've been warned by an angel. You would have died if it weren't for your donkey. Straighten out your paths and speak only the word that I tell you. So God is forcefully, dramatically, kind of humorously telling Balaam, you better get serious about obeying or else. And that takes us then into this section that I'm calling bless, bless, bless. Let me pause just for a moment. Have I missed anything, comments, questions from the text before we keep going? Okay, I think that's a no. So let's get into bless, bless, bless. This is mostly chapters 23 and 24, which again, we're going to summarize for our purposes because there's lots of really neat details that we're just not going to have time to consider. Balaam gets to Moab, and he and Balak get together, and they try to curse Israel. Balak takes Balaam up to a high place, which is typical for pagan worship. They see a part of Israel. There's another reminder of how big Israel is. They build altars, they offer sacrifices, and then Balaam says, okay, let me go see what God will maybe tell me. And he goes off, and the text is very precise to say that God puts a word into Balaam's mouth. He's given a leash that's about this long. And then he goes back and blesses Israel. And Balak responds just how you would expect. He's furious. I didn't call you to bless, I called you to curse. But let's try again. And so three times they go through this cycle. Build altars, offer sacrifices, go talk with God, bless Israel. Oh no, it happened again. And after the third time, the folks present, especially Balaam and Balak, finally seem to get it. In fact, Balaam in chapter 24 will refer to himself by the same title or description that God gives him on the road, the man whose eyes have been opened. He gets that he's not going to curse Israel this way. And as angry as Balak is, he understands that trying this anymore is completely fruitless. And so they give up this vain endeavor to curse Israel in this way. Balak is angry at Balaam. Balaam has no reward that he was hoping for, and they part their ways. And if that's where the story ended, we would say, awesome. Balaam got it. God worked it out. Everything was cool. But the story doesn't quite end there. There's one more section that we need to look at, and I'm calling that sin, judgment, and jealousy. What ends up happening, if we look at chapter 25, we're going to be in that text here in just a moment, Numbers 25, and some comments from Numbers 31, which we're not going to look at, just make reference to, we find out that Balaam stuck around. He stayed in Moab and Midian, and he kept working with those people. And it seems almost certain that he was intent on causing problems for Israel and getting his reward. And the way he did that is terrible, but somewhat clever. He figures, if I can't get God to curse these people, maybe I can get them in trouble with their God. And so he conspires with the Moabites and the Midianites to tempt them with these wicked pagan women and this wicked worship. And we would think that after 39 years-ish of wandering in the wilderness, the people would get it. And they would say, nope, we're not having anything to do with that. But no. There's a group of Israelites, probably about 24,000, that participate in that sin. And it's a disaster. Balaam finally has managed to curse some of Israel. And we're not sure how this is going to work out. What God does is he judges this sin decisively. He first judges it in Israel. A plague breaks out. And in fact, there's a whole assembly of what seems to be the vast majority of the people who are repenting and seeking forgiveness. That's good under the circumstances. But then God, after dealing with Israel, will also judge the Moabites and the Midianites. And so we learn in chapter 31 that the end of Balaam's story is that when the Israelites carry out God's judgment on these other nations, Balaam dies. You can see that in chapter 31, especially verse 8 and verse 16 in that region. So the end of Balaam's story, seeking riches and fame, is disaster and death. And that's an important lesson for us that we'll come back to in just a moment. But to see Phineas finally jump onto the scene, to see the good part of the story, and I think especially to think about what we can do with this, we need to go to Numbers 25 and especially down at verse 10. We're going to pick up there in just a moment. What ends up happening is, as I mentioned, the people of Israel are repenting and seeking forgiveness at the tabernacle. And in the midst of that assembly, there's some foolish Israelite. We're actually given his name because of how terrible this is. Some foolish Israelite, whose name I won't try and mispronounce, decides that this is the right time to bring one of these wicked women home, to continue this sin while repentance is happening by the majority of the people. That's terrible. It's complete rebellion against God. And Phineas sees it. Everybody sees it, but Phineas sees it. And he says, that's wrong, and that needs to stop. And he doesn't just sit and watch and wait for somebody to do something. In the least kid-friendly part of this story, he gets up and grabs a spear, and he goes and takes care of it. And that's the end of this foolish Israelite, and it's the end of this pagan, wicked woman. He says, that sin needs to stop, and he stopped it. And we're told in verse 8 that after Phineas has done this, the plague on the people of Israel was stopped. It's not just that one action, but there's a significant connection. The other thing that happens that's really neat begins in verse 10. We're going to read verses 10 to 13 because God has something to say about Phineas personally and individually. That's really unusual, and so it's noteworthy. The Lord said to Moses, Numbers 25, verse 10, Phineas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the people of Israel in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them so that I did not consume the people of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore, say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and to his descendants after him the covenant of a perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the people of Israel. That's awesome. That's said about a few individuals in the Bible, and it has some really neat connections to Christ that we're not going to go into tonight. But that's awesome. And if you never knew about Phineas before, I hope you'll remember him after that, because that is so, so cool. Very few people are said to share God's jealousy for his glory and his holiness. But Phineas had it. And that's where this story really ends. There's all kinds of disastrous things happening and sin and foolish decisions and evil crooked paths, but Phineas gets it. And that's where I want us to finish our consideration of this story. But then we need to turn and think about, what do we do with this? We're not Midianites, we're not Moabites, we're not coming out of the wilderness. So how do we turn this into Bible living, as we often talk about, right? And I want to suggest we do that by way of three observations that work kind of from a high-level principle down to some more detailed things that we can think and talk about. The first of which is the things that we learn about God. In my judgment, it's always important when we get through a text to say, what do we learn about God here? And then that will guide and inspire pretty much everything else that we do. And I think we learn these four things about God. He kept his promises. That means God is faithful. Always, always, always. God is sovereign. He's in control. Not Balaam, not really even the angel, not Balak, not even Phineas ultimately. God is in control. God is holy, and he expects to be treated as holy. And when his people do that, God is really, really good. We're going to talk about that in a minute from our Bible reading in Matthew chapter 5. But I think those are some fundamental things about God that stand out in this story. And here's why I would suggest those are useful to us in terms of application. If we ever struggle with believing and having confidence in those things, we can do what the psalmist did. And we can open up the scriptures and go, you know what? I don't know what God's doing right now. I might have wondered that question when the plague broke out in Israel. But I know God is these things, always. So if God tells me to do something, I can trust him and obey him. If he says don't do something, I can trust him and I can obey him. If he says that there is a reward for following him, I can take that to the bank every day, all day, because God is faithful. And in my estimation, that's really, really important. The second thing that I would suggest we talk about briefly, whoops, excuse me, I hit the wrong arrow. Here we go. It's talking about choosing the wise path. For me, this comes especially from Balaam on his trip, right? His path, there's nothing wrong with the road that he's traveling, but the path of his life was crooked and evil and perverse. And God says, you need to turn straight in the command that I gave you. That's common Bible language, right? Don't turn aside to the right or to the left, but go straight ahead. And we talk about the straight and narrow, and we've talked about the wise path in our youth lectures, and we've also talked about them in our reading in the wisdom literature. So we don't need to rehash that all the way through. But I think there's something significant for us. If you'll turn with me over to Hebrews chapter 12, I want to draw one idea from that chapter. That seems like a long ways from Balaam, and it is, but there's a great statement there in Hebrews chapter 12 that I think helps us to see this. The writer there says, beginning in verse 12 of Hebrews 12, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. There's a lot of, in my judgment, good connections between that and what we've just talked about from Numbers. But for me, here's the message. Being holy and choosing a wise path is a me thing, yes, but it's also an us thing. If you see me going on a foolish path, I'd really like you to turn me back. In fact, I'm going to ask you to do that because God says to do that. And there's great power in choosing it for myself, but there's also great power in choosing it together. Because evil companions corrupt good morals, but that can work the other way too. And I think that's a really important lesson that emerges from this text. The last one I want us to think about briefly is this that we've talked about from the Sermon on the Mount and from other passages. And it's this idea of loving God more than riches and fame. Here's what the New Testament says about Balaam. If you didn't know that he shows up in the New Testament, he does. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 15 talks in the most scathing terms about Balaam, saying of evil teachers, 2 Peter 2 verse 15, that they, forsaking the right way, have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain from wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. That's a strong indictment of Balaam and his love for the wages of unrighteousness or the gain from wrongdoing. Something very similar shows up in Jude, verse 11. Jude 11 says this, woe to them, about the same basic group, for they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. Of any group of people that you want to be associated with, it's not Balaam and Korah. Never, never, never. And it's the same idea of gaining riches and fame. The same idea shows up in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14. Revelation 2, 14 says this, but I have a few things against you. This is to the church in Pergamum. I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel. Balaam is not even close to being a good guy. He is after riches and fame, and he will do anything that it takes to get there. And that's a strong, stern warning for us that we root that out of our hearts. And I think that's where we need to start with application is, am I tempted by treasures of this world, riches and fame and gain and me, me, me? If so, I need to learn the lesson from Balaam. That doesn't end well. That path ends in death and destruction. But I think there's also a warning in those same passages that says, if I get that right, there's still going to be people out there generally floating around in the world who I may encounter who are Balaams. They will do anything it takes to get rich and famous, and they'll lead me to death if that's what it takes. And so I need to be careful for me, but I also need to be watching out there as well and make sure that I'm not led astray. And maybe if the opportunity presents itself, maybe I can be a Phineas. Not by taking up a spear, not with a spear, but that I can be Phineas with the word of God. And I can say, you know what? that's not right, and we need to stop. And we can do that right now by the power of God and through the insight from His Word. And that's why I love the story of Balaam. There's so much cool stuff in this text that's a little bit strange, but memorable and wonderful and applicable. And I thank you for considering that together with me tonight. We've got, I think, just a minute or so left, and we're going to pivot over in just a second to our song service. Again, we're not having a break in between. But let me pause and just see any other comments that anybody would like to add. I think I saw somebody pointing. I see point. Ah, Rusty, thank you. Looked everywhere but there.
You know, Phinehas eventually becomes the high priest. And so he's a great example of a group of people needing the kind of leader who's willing to stand up and say, we're not doing that. Not today, not ever. And those kind of leaders are rare.
Absolutely. Didn't hear what Rusty said. He noted that Phinehas becomes the high priest. And think about what an effective leader that is. He's not perfect as high priest, that's Jesus, but what a wonderful leader Phinehas would be, because he was jealous for God's glory and holiness and how much of a wonderful impact he could have, and how we can work to become similar leaders like that and be thankful for leaders that we have who are that kind of influence. That's a great observation. Thank you, Rusty. Okay, we're going to call it there.